And this is that. Talk to me. Talk. It's so, so wrong. Talk to me. Power on. Message is the It's very dark there, isn't it? It shouldn't be so dark. What happens if I turn the lights off? Very dark. It shouldn't be that dark. 1 second. Sorry? I still have that. Good. I was testing you. So, you can't see very much. Anyway, you don't have to see very much. It's not that important. Okay. So, exciting, exciting exercise, which you have been doing. And the best thing to do when you have an exercise is to have the answers. I have the answers. So, in contrast to, if you're listening on the internet, I uploaded this definitions exercise to the forum, so you can go and look for it. By the time you look for it, we will probably have finished. So, if you want to, you can look for it. If you don't want to, you don't want to. In contrast to romances. Novels are blah, 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 blah. And the second answer is, of course, romances as well, the second gap. Number two, in contrast to A, novella. Don't know why it's not here. It's not here, anyway. The characteristics of the modern novel are realism, coherency, unified. No. What could you unify? Plot. Plot. Or in this case, plots. Plots como tramas, not plots como complots, and not plots como huecos. Weapons. Well, not really. It means very, if something like, well, in some cases, but they tend to be quite a bit episodic. The things, the prose in the 17th century. Four. The novel concerns itself essentially with the depiction of the contemporary good world. Such as exhibit life in its true good. A fictitious narrative accommodated to the ordinary train of human, doesn't have to be historical. Prose narrative about everyday life, usually in the present, with the emphasis on huge difference with the literature beforehand, with medieval and Renaissance literature. Originality. Okay? Originality from now on is something which is valued, not despised. What is character but the determination of incident? What is incident but the Anybody? Illustration. I know what you mean in terms of identity, but illustration is the exact word. The novel is characterized as a fictional attempt to give the effect of realism by representing what's the difference between a Moll Flanders and a Sir Gawain? Sir Gawain. as in Segalian and the Cavaliero Verde, which you've forgotten all about. Ah. Complex. Yeah? We're talking about people who need to be realistically human. We have to believe that they really exist. Yeah? If we have somebody who is just two-dimensional, but not rounded, as a principal character in a novel, then a novel is flat. Yeah? We can't believe it. This is, to some extent, developing on... Really, Shakespeare had the idea of creating fissures in character. People are not consistent. Yeah? Characters, fictional characters in medieval literature are consistent. They always do what their character type says. But to make somebody realistic, they have to have contradictions. And so we have that type of complex character. Novels reject uniforms. You can have novels. Yeah. Yeah. No? Nobody? Universals. So ideas that are conceived to be universally true. It is all about specifics and detail, not about generalizations. The primary criterion is truth to individual experience. Individual experience is always unique and therefore new. Focus on specific people in specific circumstances. Excellent. Circumstances. The novel is distinguished from previous literature by its attention to that's sort of the idea. Individualization. The important thing is to establish that somebody is an individual human being. That, of course, is a relatively new idea. Yeah, previously, you are just a peasant, or you're just a knight, or something. Here, the important thing is that you are an individual, part of bourgeois culture, not based on mythology. Very good. You said mythology? Mythology. Yeah, good. Yeah. The novel broke with earlier literary traditions of using earlier literary tradition used true story. I didn't hear. Template. No. Timeless. Okay. So, with all of that, you should, if you get a question about the rise of the novel, you should be able to start off with a definition. Timeless, without time, out of time. Good. Well, that was fun. So, we will continue. What's your name, please? Alberto. Tell me where this is. Tell me where this is. That. Cayam? No, not Cayam. It is the Linea 3, you are correct. Anybody know where that is? No, it's not in Bajadores. We don't have anything as exciting as that in Bajadores. No? What's on the walls? What book? Well, there's only one book which is used as wallpaper in Spain. What book is Don Quixote? This is a national disgrace. Don Quixote is not wallpaper. You have this concept that Every year you have marathons of reading Don Quixote. So without anybody analyzing, thinking about the text, it's having five-year-old children and everybody reading a little bit of Don Quixote, and you, as a marathon, you read the whole. It's disgraceful. Nobody treats their national culture like this. As wallpaper? No, this is disgraceful. You should boycott the metro until they remove this. Anyway, which was the first novel? Right, and that is, of course, nonsense. It is a... The Tales of Genji. And what do you say? And how do you say it? You say it in Japanese. Wow, I'm impressed. I have read it, but I've read it in its big... Have you read it? Oh, it's huge. I've read it, but I've read it in English. Again, stupid. The reason this is a stupid concept is because there is no birth of a novel. The novel is something which grows over millennia. It's not something which just appears overnight. So it is as ridiculous to say, for example, that Old Flanders is the first novel as to say that Rimbaud is the first novelist, or to say that Lily is the first novelist, or to say that... The Tales of Genji, Los Cuentos de Genji in Spanish, is the first novel. We, of course, are not so childish and patriotic, so we don't say these things. We have elements of novel in the Middle Kingdom of Egypt and some of their writings, some of their prose writings, 1200 BC. So we can talk about the history of the novel developing over several millennia. There are elements of Roman fiction which have elements of novel. In fact, we have people like Lucianus, you say Spanish? Lucianus, yeah. Lucianus, we have elements of science fiction. We have people traveling to the moon and things like that. So, I mean, even something as specific as science fiction novels have a long history. And of course, we have in the Japanese tradition. The problem there again is probably that it's very episodic, and the name suggests that. It is the Los Cuentos de Genji, and they are very much a series of short stories about the same character whose character develops, and is very complex, etc., etc. There. We have, of course, a Renaissance history of the novel, with people like Rambleau, with Pantagruel, and we have Lily with Euphues, and we have Don Quixote by somebody or other. Why would we not say that Don Quixote is a modern novel? What's against describing it as a modern novel? Le Sage, Gil Blas, for the French people. Say something to the French. There's too much fantasy, and too much of it is about a parody of romance. It's too much. It's too closely linked with romance. That is not, of course, to criticise it as an absolutely enormously important part of world literature. It's just in terms of the categorisation of a novel, it doesn't necessarily fulfil all things. You could not say that not all of the elements are in place with stuff by Daniel Defoe either. So it just depends where you want to start. So we can, the idea of where the history of the novel is and where it works is enormously complex, and people can do things like that, and nobody can follow that, so we won't worry about that. But we can look at a little corner of it, and that's our little corner of it, which is the rise of the novel. And what I want you to tell me now is, what were the circumstances by which we could talk about a major step forward in the development of the modern novel in London, specifically in England, in the early 1700s, in the early 18th century? What is it that meant that there was a big step forward in the process of the novel at this time in Britain, in England? in London. Society was changing. Is that the sort of thing you're going to write in your exam? Society was how was society changing? What was changing about society? Facts, facts, facts. It's a bit early for the Industrial Revolution. I mean, there's a trade revolution, i.e. capturing people as slaves, taking them to America, bringing tobacco to Europe and all that sort of stuff. There's then an agricultural revolution, and then there's the Industrial Revolution. But the Industrial Revolution really doesn't kick off in any serious sense until about 100 years later. And with the Industrial Revolution, a transport revolution. First canals and then the railway. Urbanization. Okay, that's a very, very slow process. It's not something which... It helps, yes. But urbanization, London is gradually adding, is gradually doubling its population every 60, 70 years, but over a long period of time. No. Oh, how sad. Well, you have an excuse, and you have an excuse, but you don't have an excuse, you don't have an excuse, you don't have an excuse. I think you have an excuse. Because a lot of the reasons for the emergence of the periodical essay, about which we talked last lesson, you weren't here last lesson, no? You were here, yes. Yeah, but she wasn't, no? Yeah. So you have an excuse, she doesn't have an excuse. Okay. A lot of the reasons for the rise of the periodical essay can also be associated with the rise of the novel. For example, tea houses and coffee houses. Not really. That's one of the few things they don't have in common. Okay, we have the culture of tea houses and coffee houses, which is very important in terms of people reading the periodical essays. But novels don't tend to be read in that context. Right, the new middle class, again, a very slow process, but yes. What about the new middle class? Okay, and they had more money. This requires disposable income. If you're actually buying books are still luxury items. They're not cheap to buy a book. You can buy a pamphlet, you can buy a periodical essay without going hungry, but to buy a book requires a lot more money. So only people who can afford it are reading novels? Ah. What type of libraries? The British Library? No. What specifically type of private libraries? Bibliometro? Have they invented Bibliometro? No. But they had invented circulating libraries. So you had people basically with wagons going around, lending out books, lending out these expensive products, and people returning them, and you could actually travel around with them. And as an investment, that was quite a good investment. But of course, you don't have to be spending the same, you don't have to be filling your house up with books like I have done. And I now cannot, I have nowhere to live, but books occupy my house. It's terrible. They're terrible things, books. Much better to use Kindle. Not. Okay. Anything else? Right. So we have the development of biography. And the idea that individuals are important. And we have the development of character description, even fictional character description, which happens in the periodical essays. So, there is the development of both those types of things and the longer development of character, the development of character through interaction, which happens in many of the periodical essays over time. Good. What else? They were simple to read. Okay, well, the periodical essays had established the idea that creating clear, lucid language, as opposed to sort of philosophical, complicated, poetic language, was more attractive to the class that is developing. And the fact that specifically educating women, and a large part of the audience for novels, in the same way as the audience for periodical essays, were women, probably the majority. There are economic factors like the new presses that I talked about, and that makes printing cheaper. And there is the lapse in the censorship laws, which also affects the development of the novel. What else? What happens in terms of religion? Hugely important is the abandonment of the idea of a divine plan. If you have the idea of the great chain of being, and everything is organized, and God's planned everything, yeah? At the end of this class, I'm going to knock over my thermos and spill all my tea and be very, very unhappy, and that's all planned by God. Yeah? I have nothing I can do about it. That is anathema to anathema, sorry, anathema in Spanish, anathema to the novel, which is about incident and about people controlling incident, about cause and effect. The main difference between what happens in novels and what happens in real life is that in novels, everything happens for a reason. And the enjoyment of reading novels, in part, is from being able to follow the causality through. And the fact that you seed novels, yeah? You seed in the sense of sembrar. What develops later, you have to go back and put it into your novel so that things have cause and effect. That life isn't like that. Things just happen in life. But we love that idea that there are causes and effects. It's not the cause and effect of God in charge of everything, omniscient, omnipresent, God having decided everything beforehand. It's the idea of taking this decision. This decision has consequences. That's a hugely bourgeois idea, that you take decisions and your decisions to have consequences. Yeah? In the sort of free-for-all anarchic world of the rakes and restoration comedies and medieval values and all that sort of thing. No, it's all just God's plan. You're not really responsible. But this is all about individualism and individual responsibility. And that is hugely important in the development of the novel. Last, I can't see anything. We have the development of travel literature, and so the idea of people moving around and the idea of people moving through society becomes important. There is the slow development of epistolary novels. Okay, so the idea that people are much, much more writing letters. I've talked before about the fantastic postal service in London in the 18th and 19th century, unequaled until the invention of the telegram. Etc. People are writing a lot of letters. And so that becomes a natural means of communication and developing into the novel. Anything else? Well, here it says, why did this happen? And there's the influence of books like Don Quixote and Gargantua and things like that, the expansion of the reading public, the fusion of newspapers, the influence of Puritanism and Methodism. Well, Methodism is quite late. And I don't really agree with that. Why Puritanism? What is the importance of Puritanism? If you can't read in front of those yellow boxes. No? What form does Puritan literature take at this period? What is probably the most read book in the English language at this time, apart from the King James Bible. Quite possibly. Pilgrim's Progress by John Bunyan. Pilgrim's Progress is in many senses very medieval. It's about somebody, it's almost a dream vision, it's almost medieval in that sense. But it is about somebody's, a sinner's process towards spiritual salvation. And that sort of spiritual autobiography, how somebody takes decisions in their life and manages to improve themselves, is hugely popular at this time. We don't study it very much because it's boring as hell. But as popularity and as influence, that is hugely important at this time, and is a direct influence on a novel called Moll Flanders, which we will see. To some extent, one of the things we're doing very badly here is talking about Puritans, and Puritans are, you know, there's every flavour of, you know, you can imagine. There's raspberry Puritans, mint-flavored Puritans, and lemon-flavored Puritans, all types of Puritans, lots of different types, and they have very, very different ideas. But some of them, yes, but Pilgrim's Progress is enormously popular amongst a part of the Anglican Church as well. Also, it says here, philosophical rationalism. John Locke and René Descartes, who you unfortunately pronounce Descartes. Philosophical theories of... Well, we have the Enlightenment, the idea that we live in a rational world, and of course that helps this whole idea of causes and consequences and people taking control of their own lives. It's also very, very much related to the idea of individualism. And of course, individualism is a very, very basic concept in this emerging capitalism, which of course is actually categorized and formalized by Adam Smith a bit later in the period, but it's part of the same process. And again, part of this idea of real individual people rather than perfect types. Again, what we saw last week, with The Fable of the Bees. Remember? Right. So, what we begin to have is the development of short stories, and short stories become much more sophisticated just before this period, with people like Aphra Behn. Heard of Aphra Behn? You should have heard of Aphra Behn. A Restoration playwright, a woman who wrote very, very popular short story called Orinoco, about a prince in South America. We have character sketches coming from the periodical essays, an observation of minutiae of details about people. We have travel writing. We have the advance of biography, which we saw last time. We have collections of letters, which then can be linked into each other. And we have the Newgate calendar and the pamphlets and that sort of thing. So the novel is, by its very nature, a new hybrid form. It's taking all these elements. And you have novels which have, basically, periodical essays stuck at the beginning of each chapter. Tom Jones. Yeah? Famous Tom Jones. Beginning of every chapter, you have an essay with Fielding talking about, well, this is what makes good literature, this is what makes bad literature. You shouldn't really have ghosts in a piece of good literature because ghosts don't exist, telling you things like this as the authoritorial voice, as the narrative voice. And so people from different genres, you have somebody like Fielding coming out of theatre and writing a novel, you have other people coming out of writing, everybody coming out of writing periodical essays and different forms, and so all of that, if you like, comes together. And in terms of the epistolary novel, We have a situation, and you will read this in all sorts of places, where Samuel Richardson is writing a style book, a letter writing manual, so you know, about how to write good letters, you know, like sort of how to write good emails, a book on how to write good structured letters. It's a sign of being an educated person, and he gets overexcited. And he turns this collection of model letters into a young woman of 15 who is working as a servant in the house of an aristocrat. And she has to deflect his sexual advances. And then at the same time, he begins to respect her more, and she begins to fall in love with him. And in the end, they get married a million words later. It's very long. But, so you have him writing these model letters, and then this turns eventually into a novel. Unfortunately, this is absolute nonsense. This is a very nice story in the history of the evolution of English novels. In fact, all of the elements of epistolary novels were already there in existence. In fact, Aphra Behn had written an epistolary novel in 1683, so 70 years earlier, or 60 years earlier, which is called Love Letters Between a Nobleman and His Sister. The problem with epistolary novels before Richardson is that they are basically a little bit salacious. Yeah? And so they're not quite reputable. The whole situation with novels is that they're not really reputable. So somebody like Daniel Defoe can be hugely popular, but he's not really literary, he's not really accepted into the circles of people like Pope and Swift and people like that who write poetry. Poetry, that's what it's called. And this is why the novel is populated by women. There are huge advantages for women in writing novels. One, you're not becoming a public person. If you write theatre plays, you're sort of out there in front of the public to some extent. And being a public person leaves you open to accusations of lasciviousness and all the rest of silly misogynistic nonsense. Whereas, if you're writing novels, you can just invent a name, send it to somebody. The publisher doesn't even have to know that you're a woman, and you receive the money. So, and it's also, because it's very popular, it's a way that you can actually earn a living without losing your reputation. And, for example, somebody like Fanny Burney earned what she would earn in, I think it was Fanny Burney, 70 years as a governess from her novel Evelyn. I mean, obviously, that is a very successful novel at the time. Nobody reads it now, but it was a very successful novel at the time. But 70 years income from one novel means this is quite a good option, people. It is colonized by women, and most of the novel writers in the rest of the 18th century are, in fact, women. Suddenly, you have a situation where men realize, actually, this is the dominant literature. So they try and get it back. Now, this is that. We want it back. Give it back to us. But by that stage, the door is open. You can't, once you've had Jane Austen, say, no, women shouldn't be doing this, because the best novelist in the English language until that time has been a woman. So, you know, what are you going to do? You can't say it's not for women. Exactly the same thing happened, curiously, with the profession of pharmacy. There was a law in 1860 regulating pharmacy saying you couldn't just sell cocaine and heroin to anybody, to children. All the fun went out of pharmacy at this time. But in the law, there was no provision about it being exclusively for men. They just assumed that it was going to be exclusively for men. And so very, very quickly in Victorian Britain, a lot of women who were capable and had just enough money to open a pharmacy, opened a pharmacy, and they were presented with a fait accompli. But the authorities couldn't do anything by the time there were thousands of pharmacies up and down the country. And so, to this day, pharmacy is a female-dominated profession, just because of this mistake in the law, from the point of view of the people making the law, of not allowing them in. Because literature was poetry and theatre, and novels were nothing, women were allowed to, or almost encouraged to, write novels, and then the novel took over as the dominant form of literature. And these things happened. But anyway, there you go. So, Richardson writes, Pamela, and Pamela is very moralistic, and there's nothing, the subtitle is Virtue Rewarded, and blah, 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 and it's all very, very circumspect and respectable, etc., etc. And to some extent, Richardson does a lot to save the novel from being related to things like Fanny Hill and Moll Flanders and all of this sort of very, very terrible, salacious stuff. But Fielding comes along, and Fielding sees that this type of novel writing is ripe for parody. It's very easy to parody is a verb, yes. And so he writes Shamala. So he writes a sham, fake Pamela. And that's very funny. And then he writes about Pamela's sister, Shamala Jones, Shamala Andrews has a brother called, not sister, brother, called Joseph Andrews. And of course, Joseph Andrews now is a serious, very, very funny novel, which is considered a classic. And then from that, he writes Tom Jones, which of course is the masterpiece of the novel up to that time. And you go from a single situation of one person writing letters, Pamela's letters to her parents, letter, which obviously is a very, very restrictive form, to having letters being exchanged between different people, and so you can reconstruct things. And that actually is of influence much later than you might suppose. Frankenstein is basically an epistolary novel. It involves an exchange of letters, as we will see. The first version of Pride and Prejudice was based on an exchange of letters. And there are, I think, something like 47 letters within Pride and Prejudice. It's not an epistolary novel, because there's far too much that happens outside the letter. But letters are a primary form of communication at this time, and they have a huge influence on the novel. So, yeah. Which one? Mariah, are you saying? Or which of her novels? Mariah. Yeah. I mean, it's a pretty standard form until we really get into the beginning of the 19th century. And so you have with this great advance that is Tom Jones, you have character revealing dialogue, which is something that he learned from the theatre, and dramatic revelations, and a highly structured plot. So what he's learned from the theatre, he brings in into the novel form. What he's learned from the periodical essay, he brings in and uses that to have this omnipresent narratorial voice. But we also have elements that we can go much, much further back to people like Chaucer, in the sense we have a huge range of characters from different stages of life. The only people who romance really cares about are members of the aristocracy. And there are very few members of the aristocracy, and there are very, very few kings and generals in the novel. Those people who have been the focus of everything before are now just completely forgotten. And it's much more about real people that the bourgeois readership can actually encounter in real life. And that's joined up with a criticism of hypocrisy, great characterization, humor, generosity of feeling, and graphic action. We don't have this idea of types, and we don't have this idea of extremes of humanity in the sense of having people who are terrible villains and people who are incredibly virtuous. We have heroes who are above all positive, and somebody like Tom Jones starts off as a naive, somebody who is innocent and slowly learns how to live in society, if you like. There's much less symbolism, but there can be elements of symbolism. Tom Jones spends the novel pursuing his love, who's called Sophia. But of course, Sophia means knowledge. So there is a metaphorical interpretation of what's happening throughout the novel, even if it's not the primary element. It's there if you want it, if you like. And also, another thing that that Tom Jones does is it takes real circumstance and it mixes it in. So one of the major backdrops to what's happening in Tom Jones is the Jacobite Rebellion. In 1745, the last of the Stuart pretenders, Bonnie Prince Charlie, took an army of not very many people from France and went to Scotland and provoked a rebellion in Scotland to restore the Stuarts to the throne and to restore a Catholic dynasty. They were massacred, basically. But part of what's happening in the background of Tom Jones is mixing in elements of this real historical circumstance, which was all over and done with by the time this happened. But it's a little bit like, you know, having in the background Once of September or something like that, as to historically anchor what is being talked about. It's not history in that it happened 5 years before, 8 years before. It's not a historical novel in that sense, but it is grounding it within the society. And that is much, much more grounded, for example, than Moll Flanders. Moll Flanders, we are told, happens during the 17th century. But the reality is, there's absolutely no mention of the Civil War, there's absolutely no mention of the Republic, there's no mention of the restoration of the monarchy. It's evidently really happening in contemporary early 18th century London. And the idea that it's historical is just a way of sort of, you know, getting that idea out of the way, but it's not properly grounded. This is properly grounded in the society. What else do I have to say? There are very much still a series of remarkable coincidences. And this is something that actually continues right through to the mature novel. And people like Trollope and Sammet and Dickens have completely sort of unbelievable coincidences. Unbelievable coincidences do happen in life. And I think we've all, you know, been in Marrakesh and come across our cousin or, you know, the equivalent of. You do find strange coincidences in life. But you can get away with two or three. And for example, Jane Austen is very good at that. She allows two or three which are more or less believable, but there are not too many. In Dickens, and here with Fielding, there are just too many. And unless you very, very much have the attitude of, I'm going to suspend my disbelief and just allow a good story to be a good story, there shouldn't be quite so many, to be honest. And there are still some ideas that carry over from classicism, and from the Romans. I mean, there's this idea that Tom Jones is of noble blood. He is an orphan, but his parentage is noble. And so we sort of get the idea from what we have seen in The Faerie Queen and all sorts of, you know, basically medieval works, that that nobility will win through in the end, and it does. Yeah? So, I mean, it would actually be much more interesting if we had a real orphan, not a noble orphan, who actually wins through in the end. But we have to wait for Dickens for that sort of thing. We can tell it's part of the early history of the novel because of the level of sexual frankness. There's quite a lot of sex in Tom Jones. This becomes less and less acceptable within what wants to be considered the serious novel very, very quickly after Tom Jones. And, for example, what becomes the most popular novel of the century, and hugely popular for a century afterwards, is the most appalling book called The Vicar of Wakefield. It's by Goldsmith, by Oliver Goldsmith, who is a brilliant playwright. He wrote She Stooped to Conquer. If you ever get the opportunity to see She Stooped to Conquer, it's actually available on a filmed version on DVD, and it's brilliant. It's one of the, you begin to actually, from this time on, get comedies where you actually laugh. You know, with Shakespeare, you can see what Shakespeare's doing, but you don't actually laugh naturally. From now on, and especially later with the people who inherit from Goldsmith and Sheridan, like Oscar Wilde, it's actually funny. It's really funny. It's not just funny, given that it was written 300 years ago. It's funny. But as you will see at the beginning of next year, with the importance of being earnest. But unfortunately, for the licenciatura, we had a little bit of theatre in here. We now no longer have any theatre. I can happily, if you're interested, I can post the tutorial notes. I still have them. It won't be part of the exam or anything. We have this isolated thing of the Beggar's Opera and then nothing until next year. But that's just the way it is. Okay. Blah, blah, blah. But what it is very much free of stereotype, and we believe in these people as individuals. And there's actually, within the novel and within the literary, within these periodical essays that he puts at the beginning of each section, there's quite a lot of literary criticism, as I mentioned, within this particular novel. The next important novel is Tristram Shandy. Yeah? You heard of Tristram Shandy? Tristram Shandy is absolutely brilliant. It is basically a postmodern novel written in the late 18th century. It's a novel about writing a novel. And so there is an interaction between Sterne, the character, as Tristram Shandy, and Tristram Shandy, and there are bits which he forgets. So you have blank pages, or you have sentences which don't finish. And he talks about his own conception and birth in the third book, and it is just wonderfully postmodern, and is absolutely crazy in one sense, in terms of exploring what it means to actually be writing a novel. Don't stop doing that. Tristram Shandy. It's in the notes. Everything I say is in the notes, which you can see on the forum, so you don't have to worry about that. But really, he takes the novel as far as it can go at this stage. And what we have after this is a retreat into sentimentalism with The Vicar of Wakefield. Now, it's not completely clear whether The Vicar of Wakefield is in fact a parody, and it's Oliver Goldsmith laughing at this type of literature, this type of very sort of mawkish, moralistic literature, or if it's him just earning some money easily by writing a very, very contrived, ridiculous novel about the perfect happy family. But that's what he does. Because formally, what happens next is a huge retrocessor. Step backwards. Yeah? I couldn't think of how to say retrocessor in English at the moment. A huge step backwards, which is Gothic fiction. And Gothic fiction, to some extent, just goes all the way back to the fantasy writings of romance and has arch villains and damsels in distress who are purer than pure and ghosts and all of this type of stuff. And apparently, it is a huge step backwards in the sense that you've got to the sort of postmodern thing of Tristram Shandy, and then suddenly you're having castles and ghosts and imaginary settings and all of this type of stuff. Well, the first Gothic novel is The Castle of Otranto by Horace Walpole, the Prime Minister's son, in 1764, I think, more or less. It might be 1763, but anyway, that sort of period. And that there is a first phase of Gothic literature immediately after that, especially with Anne Radcliffe and people like that. A lot of the writers are women. And that sort of burns itself out, especially with people like Jane Austen writing parodies of it. Northanger Abbey, which is Jane Austen's first published novel, not the first thing she writes, but the first thing she published, is a spoof Gothic novel. It's laughing at Gothic novels. And then that gets taken over to America, and you have people like Edgar Allan Poe in the mid-19th century. And then it comes popular again in Britain with Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde and Dracula and Portrait of Dorian Gray, etc. Basically in the last century, the last 12 years of the 19th century. And then you have Marvel Comics and all of the 20th century stuff, and yeah, an enormous influence on Hollywood and movies. The most important novel in the first phase of Gothic literature is Frankenstein, 1830. So, click, don't do that. But it's not, in fact, a big step backwards. Because what the Gothic novel really is about, and we're going to spend a whole tutorial talking about this, is about reader response. It's about the interaction between the reader and the book, and it's about creating emotions in the reader. And it's also about psychological realism. Okay? So the novel, as it has been developed in the 18th century until the advent of the Gothic novel, is a product of the age of the Enlightenment, of rationalism. We have all these rational people going about living their rational lives. We're not like that. Yeah? We're full of fears and anxiety and all this type of thing. And that is the interest of the Gothic novel. And once you've had that, you can then go back to some extent, to Walter Scott, but above all, to Dickens, etc., 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 and you can have a development of, more importantly, people like George Eliot and really sophisticated novels in the late 19th century. So it's not, I mean, there are elements of regression of the Gothic novel, but it's an absolutely essential regression in order to move forward, I think is the idea I want to give you. Right, so what else? Well, we sort of talked about that, haven't we? So, what types of novels are there? How can we categorise novels? Well, we can talk about picturesque novels. What are the characteristics of a picturesque novel? Okay, the picturesque novel is realistic in its manner, but it is episodic in structure. It is satirical in aim, and it is written to deflate romantic or idealistic fictional forms. So, especially to deflate romance. So, we have in the tradition, in this tradition, in English, we have Thomas Nash's The Unfortunate Traveller, writing at the same time as Shakespeare. Any other picturesque novels you can think of? Well, whether La Tarea de Tormes is really a novel, it would be questionable. But that is certainly part of the tradition. So there's this idea that normally the main character is a criminal, is not some sort of heroic aristocrat. So can you think of any novel in English which is realistic in manner, episodic in structure? Thank you. Right. Mont Flanders, in this sense, is an episodic novel. And after Mont Flanders, we have a novel by Fielding called Jonathan Wild. Who he? Who's Jonathan Wild? Oh, dear. Sorry? Jonathan Wild. Will. Bill. Right, he was one of the real criminals behind the Beggar's Opera. The story of Jonathan Wild and the other guy whose name I can't remember has huge constant repercussions in literature throughout this period. We have actually a picturesque novel by Fielding before Tom Jones about Jonathan Wilde. Then we have the Bildungsroman. What is the Bildungsroman? What is Bildungsroman? Bildungsroman. I'm going to write something on the board. Talk to me. What? Probably. Perhaps. This is going to write? Yes. Yes. Was ist Bildungsroman? Novela de? Vale, sí. Okay. Well, that's fair enough. Bildungsroman. Roman is novela, en el sentido moderno. Y Bildungs está directamente relacionado con building. Yeah? So, it's the idea of a novel of construction. What is being constructed is the person, the mature adult. So, the other way of saying this in English is a coming-of-age novel. It's about this process of moving from being a child to being a mature adult. Now, normally, if we're talking about a woman, this means the process of going across the minefield, do you understand minefield? Of finding a husband. Yeah, a little bit what Pope is talking about in The Rape of the Lock. And in terms, if it's about a man, it's about becoming your own man, becoming an independent man, as it were. Can you think of any Bildungsroman in English? I mean, this in fact could be, although it goes all the way through her life, but there are elements there. It's certainly true of everything by Jane Austen. It's largely true of Tom Jones, etc., etc. I mean, it is a standard thing in novels. And in fact, it is very, very much part of medieval romance. Medieval romance is about a young man who's learnt the theory of how to be a knight, going out into the world and putting it into practice and seeing, finding out through his adventures whether he is actually honourable and noble and all of these types of things. So, I mean, Bildung's Roman is very, very, very much part of the history of literature, if you like. And we have the monologic epistolary novel. What does that mean, monologic epistolary novel? No, it's not. A monologic. No, only one writer. All the letters are written by the same person. Yeah? So Pamela, we only get letters from Pamela. We don't get the letters back from her parents. I don't know why she continues writing. She writes letter after letter, and her parents say nothing. You don't get the parents' response. Okay? Now, I mean, obviously that, in one sense, can actually be very realistic in terms of collections of letters, because unless you make copies of your own responses, you tend to have collections of the letters of other people, but you don't have the interaction. But it's very, very dull. It's a very dull structure. And the process of development of that type of novel is grindingly slow. And that's why these things take so long. And they didn't have any television. So it made no difference. We have a dialogic epistolary novels. Well, two, in fact. Yes, we have An Exchange of Letters, which is, of course, much more interesting because you have basically a conversation, like having a conversation of emails, but you have a sort of conversation. It is, in terms of the satisfaction of the writer, it is a significant advance. And for example, we have there Clarissa by Richardson, which is over a million words long. It is this thick. The paperback breaks in two very, very quickly. One of the typical things that happens when you study literature at Cambridge University is that in the first week you are given 2 weeks to read Clarissa. And so that is their way of finding out if people really want to study literature or not. Obviously some people do, and some people just buy the Cliff Notes. And do it that way. Okay, then there's a polylogic epistolary novel where you get letters from all sorts of people exchanging. Frankenstein would be an example of that. We have letters from a number of different sources. We have memoir novels. Okay, a memoir novel is somebody recalling their life, going through their life and recalling what happened there. Can you think of an example of that? Well, there's a novel called Mole Flanders, again, which could easily be described as a memoir novel. We have novels, by the way, next week we will be talking about Mole Flanders, and you should have finished. Yes? I hope. Novel of character, where the greater of interest is in terms of describing the central character's motives and working out what he or she will do. Pamela could be described as this, Mole Flanders possibly could be described as this. We're not talking about exclusive categories, but things can be in both. A novel of incidents, yeah, where the most important thing is all of the interesting things that happen in the life of the protagonist and what's going on, which is out of the ordinary. Any example of that? Robinson Crusoe could probably be described as a novel of incident. And then we have the sentimental novel, or the novel of sentiment, or sometimes called the novel of sensibility, where the object of this type of novel is to illustrate the connection between this acute sensibility and true virtue. An adherence to strict morality and honour, combined with copious feeling and a sympathetic heart. Okay, so very much sort of emotional, gooey things, an element of it in Pamela, much, much worse in the Vicar of Wakefield. Now, another way that we can categorise novels is in terms of the narrator. Some novels have a first-person narrator. Can you think of any examples? Moll Flanders? Yes. Gulliver's Travels, before that. And we have things like Tristram Shandy, which is also the case. We might have a frame narrator, where you have somebody talking at the beginning and the end, and then the story happening in the middle. More flowers. Yeah, we have the idea of the narrator saying, I heard this story was told to me, and then you get the first-person narrator in between. A limited third-person narrator. What is a limited third-person narrator? Okay, so the narrator is some type of anonymous friend, acquaintance, or whatever, or who is around in the background, but can only know what somebody who is listening in on things could know, but can't know everything. No. Because an unreliable narrator is often omnipresent, but they might not actually be telling you the truth, or they might have their own agenda. Yeah. Whereas a limited third-person narrator is just telling you what's happening, but as if they're at ground level, they're not up in the sky. So if you have somebody up in the sky who knows what everyone is thinking, everybody is feeling, and is just telling you, omniscient third-person narrator, good. A third-person subjective narrator is a narrator who conveys the thoughts, feelings, and opinions of one or more of the characters, so you see things from that character's point of view. And that character can be described as what's the term we use for the character through whose eyes we see the world, as it were. Who would be our Elizabeth Bennet in Pride and Prejudice? That's the centre of consciousness. Yeah? The person through whose eyes we see things is described as the centre of consciousness. It's good to use some of these terms because the people that sent it will be hugely impressed in the example, as will I in your pack. And then we have a third person objective narrator which employs a narrator who tells the story without describing any of the character's thoughts, opinions, or feelings. Instead, it just gives an objective, unbiased viewpoint. And I give you a slideshow there explaining what is happening. So, that more or less is that in terms of you've got to go. We're going to spend 10 minutes talking about really important stuff, and you're going to miss it as well. Anyway, do you have any questions? Moll Flanders. Yeah, I will post the tutorial notes for Moll Flanders either tonight or tomorrow morning, so you have an ample opportunity to read those as well as finishing the novel, so that we can spend the class hopefully interacting about ideas, and not just me going blah, 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 and you looking bored. Okay, go. We have interesting things to talk about. No, go. Get out. For example, I have another picture, which is this types of the novel. I'll just do that one. So, any questions? Any impressions so far about Moll Flanders? There's absolutely no way we can cover all this in the notes. In the class, so we can use our 10 minutes. Bye bye. Are you enjoying it? Uh-huh. Okay. I mean, this whole idea of getting into somebody's head is relatively new, so it has to be worked through what actually works and what doesn't. But except is it, though, because she's not a very logical person, is she? She wants to be. Yeah. She. But we're all a bit like that, aren't we? I mean, that, in one sense, that's quite realistic, in the sense that a posteriori, you want to seem as though you made a reasonable decision. I mean, and the reality is today, most crime is spur-of-the-moment thing. It's somebody seeing a window open. It's not Michael Caine having planning a huge robbery, and you know, okay, that happens occasionally, but most crime is people just seeing an opportunity, looking both ways and going for their opportunity in whatever circumstance. It's not planned. That she is afterwards justifying herself. Again, there's elements there in the spiritual biography that come in there, that whole sort of examining her conscience and this type of thing. Do you find her likable? Do you find Moll Flanders likable? Yeah? Well, it depends where you're coming from, doesn't it? I mean, to some extent, in what role is she unquestionably bad? Oh, spoiler alert! No. From how far through are you? Two-thirds? Okay. Well, then it's very clear already. She is the worst mother ever. Yeah? I mean, you know that from a couple of chapters in. Why? And that why you can interpret that in all sorts of different ways. But why is she the worst mother ever? So she has zero maternal instinct.
Yeah.
Okay. I think there's various ways of interpreting this. One possibility is that it is a man trying to put himself in the mindset of a woman. And so possibly we see Daniel Defoe failing most in that he is unable to have maternal instinct. No, not necessarily. No, I'm not saying that necessarily. Possibly. I'm saying that's a possibility. I'm not saying that is the reason. Any other reasons? In one sense, it's hugely realistic. Because we have a baby born to a woman in prison who has not known any natural mother, and has basically been bouncing around until the age of 7. Yeah? And if we accept, what's his name? Jesuita. The original person who founded the Jesuits. St. Ignatius. Ignatius Loyola. Yeah? San Ignacio. Said, give me a child of 7 and blah, blah, blah. Yeah? You know this quote? San Ignacio said, if you give me a child of 7, I will create a, you know, by the age of seven, a child is moldable to what you want to make that child. Yeah, so from the age of 7, you can make good Jesuits. Until the age of 7 and after that, she has some sort of substitute mother figures, like Madame Midnight, but she doesn't really have any proper maternal model to follow. So absolutely natural that she just doesn't work in that sort of sense. And it's a little bit like, when you have a baby rhinoceros that somebody's killed the mother. Yeah, and the animal does not know how, or elephant, or yeah, whatever. You know, when you have an animal that has been taken away from its mother, it doesn't know how to do that because it's never seen that. And that's, to some extent, what we have in her case. And of course, it's also the very real situation that without any type of birth control, babies just happen. There's no planning, there's no wanting, they just happen. And a woman in her circumstances, they just happen a lot. That is what students often find least likable about her, this just absolute absence of a maternal instinct. But I think you could argue that it is quite realistic, given her circumstance, and quite modern almost. Yeah, to some extent it is. I mean, to be honest, what tends to happen is, I mean, she doesn't just abandon her children. She leaves her children with people who are going to look after them better than she can. And so, for example, when the younger brother gets her pregnant, she leaves her children from the younger brother with his family. And they're going to have a far better life with his family than with her. So it's a lack of maternal instinct, but it's not that she's amoral or just discards them. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Any other reactions to the novel? Well, I hope you have lots of reactions by next week, because I'm going to expect you to all be talking constantly about it. Okay, well, it's more or less time. But, of course, we have before the Peck, we have one novel. So, almost certainly, Moll Flanders is going to come up in the Peck, and it could come up in the exam as well. Obviously, the logical order of things, without wanting to second guess the Equivocal Centre too much, but is that there's going to be a major question in the Peck about Moll Flanders, and the exam is going to ask you something about Pride and Prejudice. And yeah, you can pretty much count on that. You do need to have read this one. And remember that, as I said, the film, and they had the film on television about a week ago, of Moll Flanders, the one with the wonderful Morgan Freeman, has very little to do with the novel. It goes a long way. There's no Morgan Freeman in the novel, to start off with. So be careful about that. If you want, once you've finished reading the novel, to watch an audiovisual version, there is a television series in about four episodes, I think it was, with one of the doctors from ER, from Urgencias, and Daniel Craig. Oh, now they're interested. it follows the novel much, much more closely. That is a reasonable, I mean, if you weren't going to actually read the novel, which you must do, I want you to, but if you weren't going to read the novel, you would get a reasonable idea by watching that series. I don't know whether you can get it on YouTube or from Mule or these things that you use. I don't know how to use them. But I don't care if you find them, wherever you find them, find them. But after you've finished, if possible, just as something to contrast with. Okay, go away. Go. So, I did turn this on, didn't I? Or did I not? I did turn it on. Thank God for that.